I'm going to ask Dave Leonard up front. Everyone give him a round of applause. Bruh.
Bruh.
All right, this is David Leonard. Now, Dave, just to square the ledger, you're a psychiatrist.
Yeah, bro.
Yeah? And to square the ledger, you don't know me, eh?
No, can't even recognise you.
Beautiful. Because Crush isn't one of your patients because you got, like, that privilege thing, eh?
Yeah, no, can't deny anything. Yeah.
Sweet. Excellent. Now, you're from Kiwiland, bro?
Yeah, bro. Good accent, bro.
Choice.
Oh, yeah.
So who's the current New Zealand surf world, like, champion thing?
Man, I don't know. Do they surf in New Zealand? There's too much ice down there, isn't there? I'm not quite sure.
Okay. Right.
No, actually, I think there's a Kiwi girl who's actually quite good.
Okay.
But I don't know her name.
All right. Okay. All right. So do you surf yourself?
No. I often told I look like a surfer. The closest I've got is snowboarding. And I'll tell you a wee story about that. I mastered the turn where you face uphill, but when you turn and face downhill, I always overbalanced and ended up on my backside for the whole day. To the point where I was so sore I couldn't sit down at dinner at the end of my day snowboarding. So that was it. My one day, I'm gone.
Yeah, like that falling off backwards thing. In Australia, we call it falling off. So, yeah.
All right, yeah, okay, yeah. You're pretty intelligent over here.
Oh, mate, yeah. Well, our Penrith way in particular, eh, you know. Up the Central Coast here, they're a bit duller, mate, so keep your words to a couple of syllables. So you're a psychiatrist on the Central Coast?
Yeah, I am a psychiatrist on the Central Coast. Work partly in the hospital system, partly in private practice down in Gosford.
Yeah, keep you pretty busy up here, bro?
Well, you know, that's why I moved over here from New Zealand. There wasn't enough work over there, so...
Mate, that's such a good joke. I'm leaving the stage. I'm going to let you take over.
Yeah, well, look, it's totally relaxed and chilled up here. It's all good. But look, I want to begin with a question. Hopefully I'm not going to mess this microphone up too much. But what do we imagine when we picture the image of an addict? I want you to consider the following descriptions, which I'd suggest are somewhat typical of the mental images we have of the addict. So the first comes from a textbook written in 1909 by a couple of British professors. And they wrote this. They said, "The sufferer is tremulous, loses his self-control. He's subject to fits of agitation and depression. He loses colour and has a haggard appearance. The appetite falls off and symptoms of gastric catarrh may be manifested. The heart also suffers. It palpitates. As with other such agents, a renewed dose of the poison gives temporary relief, but at the cost of future misery." Or consider this description of the same substance by a French person. "Black as the devil, hot as hell, pure as an angel, sweet as love." Or finally, this description from 1674. "A little of this substance leads men to trifle away their time, scald their chops, and spend their money, all for the little base, black, thick, nasty, bitter, stinking, nauseous puddle of water." Anybody got any idea what the substance is they're referring to there? Coffee, absolutely, bingo. So I'm not going to ask for a show of hands as to who had some coffee this morning. Yeah, it's at the table, yeah, it gives it away, yeah. All right, well, on the contrary, let me give you this description from the same textbook by the same British professors. "This substance is used, rightly or wrongly, in many Oriental countries, not as an idle or vicious indulgent, but as a reasonable aid in the work of life. A patient of one of us took a grain in a pill every morning and every evening for the last 15 years of a long, laborious, and distinguished career. A man of real force of character, concerned in affairs of weight and of national importance, of stainless character, he persisted in this habit as one which gave him no conscious gratification or diversion, but which toned and strengthened him for his deliberations and engagements." Any thoughts about the substance?
Opium,
absolutely. Very good. So opium is a relative of heroin and was very commonly used amongst the upper class going back 100 years or so ago. The point I'm trying to make here is we've got to be very careful not to be judgmental when we come to the question of addictions, because moral attitudes towards addictions change. So for instance, coffee, which I mentioned before, was at one stage banned by the Catholic Church. It was deemed to be an ecclesiastical crime to drink coffee. And Charles II in England in 1675 tried to bring about prohibition around the drinking of coffee because he believed that it corrupted men's minds. The second point I want to make about addictions is that, unfortunately, addictions are sadly not uncommon. In 2007, the Australian National Mental Health Survey found that 5.1% of the population suffered from a substance use disorder within the previous 12 months. So if you put that into Central Coast terms, that's about 15,000 people on the Central Coast. They're also increasing in frequency. A New South Wales study found that only 14% of those born from 1940 to 1944 had used cannabis at some point in their life. When you move forward to the cohort between 1975 and 1979, 63% of people had used cannabis at some point in their life. The age of onset is also becoming younger. Over half of those born between 1980 and 1984 reported drinking alcohol before the age of 15 years. But if you go back to the 1940 to 44 cohort, only 16% of those had drunk alcohol at a young age. But I don't really want to spend this talk focused on severe addiction. So I really want to talk about other types of things like habits and preoccupations or patterns of habitual use, which I'd suggest are far more common than even those statistics suggest. And in fact, I'm going to make a fairly radical claim that we're all addicts of one sort or another. You see, if you take a dictionary definition of addiction, it says this: it's the condition of being abnormally dependent on some habit. Or another dictionary defines it as a habitual or compulsive involvement in any activity. I'm not going to ask for show of hands, but how many of us can claim that none of our behaviors ever fall into these categories? I know that for myself, I certainly can't claim that. You see, we tend to think of addictions as being addicted to substances. So our mind casts our ideas around alcohol and illicit drugs. But what about substances that are acceptable amongst suburbanites? Maybe chocolate. You see, science has shown that chocolate stimulates the same centers in the brain as heroin, and that regular consumers of chocolate describe cravings between use, and that there are similar psychological and physical characteristics amongst regular users of chocolate compared to other types of addiction. So, for example, just the mere image of chocolate will often get people salivating. What about behaviors? Again, our mind tends to jump to severe types of behaviors, like pathological gambling. But what about behaviors that wives complain about commonly? The addiction of watching sports. Within the English language, there are many patterns of addictive behavior. So when we talk about addiction to work, we talk about the workaholic, or the addiction to shopping is the shopaholic. In fact, the two often go together. He works and she shops. Then there's the compulsive liar, which is very commonly seen amongst teenagers. There's the internet addiction. Now, apparently this is on the rise everywhere except for Woi Woi, because they haven't heard about the internet down there, apparently. And then there are the quite frankly weird addictions. There's pagophagia, which is an addiction to frozen ice, apparently only seen amongst Eskimos, though. Then there's crackberry, which is an addiction to a blackberry. And there's tanorexia, the addiction to tanning oneself. But for the totally weird, how about this one? A Brazilian man called Louis suffers from what he calls an addiction to funerals. The 42-year-old man has attended every single funeral in the town in which he lives for the past 20 years. He's quit his job to be able to feed his addiction. The first thing I do every morning, he says, is turn on the radio to find out if anyone has died. If I don't hear it on the radio, I call the hospitals and the local funeral homes. But if you think that's weird, a spokesperson for the local funeral home said this: we don't want him to go to therapy. Everyone expects him to be at the funeral. So if there are all kinds of addictions, then how do we know when our love for something has crossed the line to becoming an addiction? As Robert Palmer sung, you might as well face it, you can even be addicted to love. So I'm going to begin with a story here, which is a story of the more extreme form of addictive behavior. It's a story about pathological gambling, a lady called Jackie. And she wrote this. I'm a single mum. I have three children. The first time I played the pokies, I won $25. And it was such a wonderful feeling that I tried to get that feeling back again. So I continued to play for a number of years. It took over my life. Nothing or anybody else mattered to me anymore. I started to neglect the people I love the most, my children in particular. Many nights I played all night, sometimes until 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, leaving my daughter in bed and not telling her where I was going. In the morning I was tired, and I very often called in sick for work. Money was a major problem. I had to cut back on essentials like buying food, and also everyday expenses like clothes and other social activities, just normal things that families do. I was incredibly moody from one day to the next. My moods were completely unpredictable, and I was snappy to everyone around me. I was afraid to answer phone calls because they were mainly companies and people that I owed money to. Now, I'm using this more kind of extreme story about addiction to highlight a few of the key features of addiction. So the first feature of addiction is discontrol. Discontrol is where a behavior becomes a habit and then an addiction when we lose the control over that behavior. We find ourselves on the slippery slope. It's the kind of thinking pattern that goes something like, I shouldn't. Oh, well, maybe just once. Well, now that I've broken my New Year's resolution, what the heck? See, for Jackie, she said this, it took over my life, that her gambling had got so out of control that it started to consume her life. For myself, I am a self-confessed chocolate addict, and for Christmas, I seem to be given a diabetic load of chocolate. My thought pattern goes something like this. I'll just have 2 pieces, and then I'll put it away. But the 2 pieces become 3, becomes 4, and before I know it, the whole king-size bar of chocolate's gone. But for other people, it may be something like just another game on the internet, or it may be that it's something like another 5 minutes on Facebook, or it may be spending an extra $10 on shoes, and then $20 and $30 and $40 until suddenly you find you've got a closet like Imelda Marcos, who reportedly had 7,500 pairs of shoes. You see, we can find a million excuses for our behavior. When I was studying, I actually managed to persuade myself that doing computer games was good for your memory and helped me with my study. So what is the red flag alarm for us? If we find that there's a pattern of behavior in our lives which we're struggling to resist, a pattern that's becoming a stronger habit, or a pattern that is unbalanced and increasingly enticing, that is an alarm that perhaps we're losing a little bit of control over this behavior. What do we need to do about it? Well, first of all, we've got to acknowledge the issue. We have to admit our struggles. The 12-step program is probably the most successful program for treating addictions. The first step in the 12-step program is that you have to admit that my life has become unmanageable. You have to acknowledge the problem. I have a friend who went through AA, and he says that the first step is actually the hardest step. And I'd suggest the reason behind that is to do with the issue of pride, which I'll come on to a bit later. The other thing we need to do is we have to put the boundary a long way back. You see, how do I avoid the wipeout on the surfing wave? Well, you just don't get on the wave until you're able to ride the wave. To use an analogy of a cliff, if we don't want to fall off the cliff, you don't tiptoe on the edge of the cliff face. You put the barrier a couple of meters back from the cliff face so that you're not in any risk of falling off. When we work clinically with people, we encourage them to aim for abstinence, which is to say, don't even dabble with it, because as soon as you dabble with it, you're in dangerous water. The other tip I would suggest is it's helpful to have someone to keep you accountable. If you went back many generations in communities, there was the priest, and people would go and confess to the priest. We don't have that structure in our society anymore, but there is something valuable about somebody else keeping you accountable and what you're doing. And I think that's one of God's blessings in terms of marriage, that you have somebody there in the same house who keeps you accountable day in, day out for what you're doing. Friends are also very helpful for keeping you accountable. So for me, how do I deal with the chocolate addiction? I avoid buying chocolate, especially when I'm stressed or down, because I know that these are vulnerable states. And late at night, I know that this is a bad time for self-control. So sitting down in front of the television with chocolate late at night is very dangerous. But on top of that, my daughter keeps me accountable. She came home from school armed with facts about healthy eating and reminds me that chocolate is a special treat food, not a regular food. She also reminds me that carrots are good for your vision and fiber is good for your bowels. And she also helpfully told me the correct sitting position for emptying your bowels. Yeah, it's quite amazing what kids are learning at school these days. So the second feature of addictions is the idea of salience. So salience is where a behavior begins to consume more and more of our time and becomes an increasing priority in our lives. Our lives become unbalanced with more energy and emotion invested in this behavior. It begins as an interest and then moves to a fascination, then a preoccupation, before consuming more and more of our lives. So if I go back to the story of Jackie, she said this, "Nothing or anybody else mattered to me anymore. Many nights I played all night, sometimes until 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning." For myself again, I do a bit of skiing. I gave up on snowboarding, not surprisingly, and went back to skiing. But when I go on a skiing trip, I find myself checking the computer, looking at the snow reports, seeing what the weather forecasts are, seeing what the snow depth is. And I find myself, the closer I get to my skiing trip, spending more and more time in this behavior. For others, it may be something benign or even something good that we invest our time in. I had a friend who developed an interest in cycling. It began as a periodic thing to get fit, then it moved on to a regular thing. And then he started taking it up competitively, and ultimately it became his main focus. Sadly, his marriage broke down, and I'm sure that in part of that was because he spent so much time cycling. As this, it could be something like time spent on Facebook, or it could be time spent on self-appearance, or the way we dress. My wife will attest to this, that is not a problem that I'm going to have. It could be about the time we spend at work, or the time we spend with our children. It could be about our love of music that becomes a preoccupation. Or it could be something totally weird, like collecting teaspoons. But the point is, it's something that takes over more and more time in your life. So what's the red flag? What's the warning sign for us here? I'd encourage you periodically to sit down and reflect on how you spent your week. Is there anything that seems to dominate your week? If so, why is this dominating your week? Look at your bank statements. Is there anything that stands out there? Because money is often a reflection of our priorities. What dominates your thoughts when you're in the shower, or when you're in the car by yourself, or when you lay down at night? Are these healthy concerns, or are we getting preoccupied with certain things? So moving on to how do we deal with the issue? Again, we need to have the courage to admit that our life has become unbalanced. Sometimes seeing it in black and white can be helpful, like the bank statement or the diary of your time spent. We are all prone to self-denial and justifying our behavior. You see, Facebook is a good way of connecting with others. That is very true, but 10 hours of connecting a day, that's a lot of connecting. More broadly, I'd suggest that we need to ensure we have a good balance in our lives. And Sigmund Freud, who is the father of modern psychology, said this, that mental health consists of a balance of work, love, and play. Work has many benefits for us. There's benefits in terms of contributing, in terms of achieving, in terms of social contact, in terms of structure and routine. So it's not all just about the money. And I'm not necessarily talking about work in the sense of paid work. Work can be volunteer work, or it can be domestic work. And on that note, I think the role of the mother in our society, unfortunately, is very undervalued. I think mothering is the most important job that you can do. But we need to make sure that our work is in balance with love, which is our relationships. We don't want to have any regrets with regards to our relationships. You know, Mike and the Mechanics sung in the 1980s this song, "I wasn't there that morning when my father passed away. I didn't get to tell him all the things I had to say. I just wish I could have told him in the living years." We want to make sure that we don't have regrets with our relationships. Play. Play is about fun. It's about having downtime. It's about having hobbies. So it is about surfing. It is about skiing. It's about collecting teaspoons. But making sure that those things don't get out of balance with other things in our lives. So for me, to address the snow report issue, I have to consciously check myself and remind myself not to get preoccupied with snow. At the end of the day, it is only white, fluffy stuff. I'm also prone to being a workaholic. And it may begin with the right intentions of wanting to help people, wanting to provide for my family, wanting to help my colleagues, but it can get out of control and become destructive. So I've determined that I need to admit this is an area that I need to be careful about. I need to listen to my wife, and I need to check in with my colleagues, which I do formally once a month through a formal meeting that we have. The other aspect of addictions is cravings. This is where we start to desire the substance or behavior more and more. So for Jackie, she said this, "It was such a wonderful feeling that I tried to get that feeling back again." This time I'm going to use a different illustration to myself, although some people do say we look alike, particularly when I don't brush my hair. Those of you that remember the film, or the really hardcore people that have read the book, The Lord of the Rings, will remember the character Gollum. Gollum is the one that has the desire for the ring, you know, "My precious, my precious." Gollum became totally preoccupied with the ring. It dominated his life. He constantly craved the ring. So what is the red flag alarm for us when we start to crave things? Finish these sentences, "I love dot, dot, dot," or "I can't do without dot, dot, dot." That gives us something of an idea of what things we desire, what things we crave. Consider this story, which was from a recent treatment session. In this session, I was providing group therapy for four young mothers and their small children. "You all have addictions," I observed. To the first mother, I said, "You're addicted to eating. You even named your daughter Candy." I turned to the second mum. "Your obsession is money. Again, it manifests in your child's name, Penny." I turned to the third mum and I said, "Your addiction is alcohol and your child's name is Brandy." At this point, the fourth mother got up, took her little boy by the hand and whispered, "Come on, Willie, let's go home." So how do we deal with this issue? Well, clearly the answer is you marry an ugly husband. No, I'm not talking about that. But anyways, it's similar to the previous advice. We need to have a balance of interests in life. Don't spend too much time consumed with one interest. Don't allow yourself to become too fixated on one thing. How did Gollum finally end up dealing with his cravings? Well, sadly, he didn't. It ended up being destroyed. But what about Frodo Baggins, who did deal with the preoccupation with the ring? He didn't allow himself too much time focused on the ring. Whenever he was drawn in by the desire of the ring, he had to physically pull himself away from its enticement. Frodo focused on the long-term goal, which was the journey to Mordor and the mission he had been given. And most importantly, he had a loyal and protective friend, Samwise Gamgee, who in my mind is the true hero of the story. The final feature of addiction I want to talk about is impairment. This is where our habits are so out of control and our priorities are so distorted and our time so consumed and our desire so intense that it starts to impact on our life in a negative way. This is really where a habit crosses the line into being an addiction. For Jackie, she said this, "I had to cut back on the essentials like buying food and everyday expenses like clothes. Just normal things that families do. I was afraid to answer phone calls because they were mainly companies and people I owed money to." But it doesn't have to be that extreme. It can affect our work, our relationship, or finances in lesser ways. Consider the husband who works too long, leading to a grumpy wife and kids growing up not knowing their father. Or the person who wastes their day aimlessly on the internet. Or the woman who is so caught up with knitting that she burns her scones. So what is the red flag alarm? One of the screening questionnaires we use for alcohol addiction is called the CAGE questionnaire. It's an acronym. So C is for cutting down. A is for other people annoyed by your behavior. G is do you feel guilty about your drinking? And E is do you have an eye opener? In other words, do you drink in the morning? The difficulty cutting down touches on discontrol. The guilt is touching on salience. The eye opener is talking about cravings. But notice the fourth item. Do other people get annoyed by your drinking? Why is it other people? The reason for this is that none of us are particularly good at judging the impairment caused by our addictive patterns until we hit rock bottom. It's because the addictive cycle distorts our judgment. I'd suggest that Jackie wrote this story when she was in recovery. The tragedy is, at the peak of her addiction, I would suggest that she did not recognize what essentials meant, or her idea around what a normal family did was distorted by her gambling behavior. See, for my cycling friend, he never saw the marriage breakdown until it was too late. For the workaholic father, it is often only after the kids grow up that he recognizes he got his priorities wrong. For the shopaholic, it is only when they can't pay their credit card bill that they recognize there is a problem. So how do we deal with this issue? Two things. We need to listen and we need to be humble. Listen, because we all have psychological blind spots. We are fooled if we only trust our judgment and if we ignore the wisdom of others. We need to listen because we may not see the damage that is occurring in our lives. But to listen, we have to have friends and family. I think one of the tragedies of modern society is we live in urban centers where we're all crammed in close to each other, but we have no sense of community. People are not connected to one another. So it's very important that we invest in relationships with other people around us. Humility. We need to be able to acknowledge our imperfections. We need to admit that we fail sometimes, and we need help from others. It is the fool who thinks they know everything. Western society has been described by some as a culture of narcissism. Now, narcissism is an extreme of vain pride. But let me tell you about the root of the word narcissism. Narcissus was a character in Greek mythology. He was a hunter renowned for his beauty. He became drawn into his own reflection in the lake, such that he spent all his time looking at his reflection in the lake. The tragic end of the story is he became so obsessed with his reflection, he fell into the lake and drowned and died. So there is a danger if we become too caught up in anything. And I think that our society has an unhealthy emphasis on pride, and thus we too are affected by a sense of pride. C.S. Lewis, the British writer who wrote the Narnia series, said that pride was the primary problem of mankind. And unfortunately, this pride can often get in the way of us seeking help. There is an old saying, a problem shared is a problem halved. But gee, do we have difficulty admitting that we need help? So, to conclude, how do we avoid the wipeout of addiction? When we love something and it gets out of control, when it starts to dominate our lives at the expense of other things, when we crave it continually, and when it starts to cause us problems in our work, relationships, and well-being, that's a sign that the behavior is moving towards an addictive pattern. How do we deal with it? Well, we need to humbly admit that we have a problem. We need courage to ask for help. We need self-discipline to keep our distance from the problem. We need wisdom to focus on the things we can change, and accountability and encouragement from those around us to help protect us from the pattern. In closing, some of you may be familiar with the Serenity Prayer that was adopted by AA. They say that laughter is the best medicine. So I'm going to finish on this, the Senility Prayer. This is something we can look forward to quoting later on in our life. The senility prayer goes as such. God, grant me the senility to forget the people I never liked anyways, the good fortune to run into the ones I do, and the eyesight to know the difference. On that note, I'll finish up my talk.
Thanks, Dave. That was heaps insightful, eh? Probably should have known that thing about names, eh? Because, like, my best mate, Carjack, and his buddy, Assault and Battery. Oh, you know, I wonder why they was always getting into trouble, eh? But now you've sort of explained it. And I reckon you've given a new edge to that thing around Dawn Patrol with that dude who hangs around chasing funerals, eh? He's not looking for ways, he's looking for dead people. But seriously, Dave, that was really good. I appreciate your thoughts and your insights. You talked about AA and NA. There's a thing at the lakes here we call Celebrate Recovery. It's been running for a while, and it's taken from the principles of the fellowship, and it puts a God focus on it. Because it tries to say to people, you can't be in control. God's got to be in control. And if you keep getting that wrong, if you don't put yourself in the passenger seat and you're in the driver's seat, then you're going to have a whole lot of pain and mischief. So, but thanks for reinforcing that, Dave. Really appreciate that. And a round of applause. You hanging around for a while, Dave?
Yeah, bro.
Cool. I didn't mean in Australia. I meant like hanging around the tent for a while, huh?